World Famous Phil Henry Show tonight on Crime Night. Joining us is the award-winning author Neil Bascom, whose latest book is Hunting Eichmann, How a Band of Survivors and a Young Spy Agency Chased Down the World's Most Notorious Nazi. And for Hunting Eichmann, Bascom tracked down former Nazi soldiers. He met with Mossad operatives. He interviewed members of the El Al flight crew involved in Eichmann's transport to Israel. And he's also made numerous archival discoveries, including the passport that Eichmann used to escape Europe with. And Neil is joining us now online. And Neil, what an amazing story, a great police thriller. It involves the history of World War II and this thing of escaped Nazi war criminals. Eichmann, I guess, being the biggest of them all in terms of capture. I don't know where we start, but tell us who Adolf Eichmann was in the hierarchy of Nazi Germany.
He was, I mean, to put it simply, he was the operational manager of the Holocaust. He was the individual responsible for largely rounding up Jewish populations and bringing them to Auschwitz door. So that was from everything from the trains to deceiving them to putting them into ghettos to orchestrating how to round up the Jewish population.
And he was a member of the SS. He was an Obersturmführer, which means he was a very high-ranking officer. And as an SS member, he swore a personal oath to Hitler. So ideologically, he was highly indoctrinated, correct?
Oh, he was highly indoctrinated. But I think what's interesting about Eichmann is that over the course of his career, and you can see this in his memoirs, he became more and more rabidly anti-Semitic. At the beginning, he was not as bad as at the very end. It was even Himmler had to bring him back off the reservation.
Really? Now, he was also, and we'll get into this story, but we need some background on this man. He was present at the Wannsee Conference, which is noted because this had a lot of Nazi Germany's luminaries, and this is where the final solution was eventually discussed and decided upon. He was like the little note taker there, wasn't he? He was like the official recording secretary at that thing.
Yeah, I mean, he had two roles. I think he was definitely the secretary taking notes. But if you see what was talked about, it was Eichmann who was providing most of the information about the Jewish populations and where they were throughout Europe. So he was, that was his role, is to be the one in charge of Jewish affairs.
Hey, Neil, before we get into his eventual escape, I wanted to ask you, I can't think of anybody bigger that Mossad or any of the Allied powers were able to bag after the war. He is the biggest prize of them all up to this point, isn't he?
No, I would say that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
You have Dr. Mengele, but they never got him.
Never captured him. All right, so the war has now ended. It's gone completely south for the Nazis. People are trying to get out any way they can. How does Adolf Eichmann get out, and does he leave alone? Does he bring family? How does he eventually escape Europe?
He uses what's called the Nazi red lines, which were orchestrated by the Argentinian government with the help of individuals within the Catholic Church who arranged for Eichmann to go from northern Germany, where he was hiding in the forest, throughout the late 1940s, and they secured a passport for him, they secured a ticket, and any papers he needed to finally arrive by boat to Argentina, where a job was waiting for him and papers were waiting for him there.
This was a highly organized escape route for these individuals. Can you comment, Neil, on the involvement of the Vatican in any of this, in getting Adolf Eichmann specifically out? Were they involved in his escape?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear, and I would not say that it was a Vatican policy. I think that's an absolute error, but there were certainly individuals within the Vatican and within the Catholic Church who helped this, and I think, there is the proof of that is, it can't be denied.
Yeah, there's a lot of documented proof of that. We're speaking here with Neil Bascom, who's authored a book called Hunting Eichmann. So Eichmann gets to Argentina. And what is the year now we're talking about? Late 40s, 50?
1950. He arrives in Argentina, and 2 years later, he brings his whole family there. So he's set up a whole new life.
Now, your book title indicates how a band of survivors, as well as the young Mossad, tracked him. At this particular point, Simon Wiesenthal had been working with the Allies right after his release from a concentration camp and had begun his own career as a Nazi hunter. So can you kind of parallel what is Wiesenthal doing at this particular point?
Well, it was Wiesenthal and a couple of other individual Nazi hunters who were really the only people going after these escaped war criminals. The governments of the United States, West Germany, England, and even after the creation of the Israeli state, they were not interested in going after war criminals. So it was left to individuals like Wiesenthal to help track him down. And by the mid-1950s, in fact, even Wiesenthal had given up. And so you find that by 1955, 1956, there is literally nobody looking for these individuals.
And he began to have contact with people as to the whereabouts of Adolf Eichmann. Some of them, were they not former German soldiers or German SS?
Yes. I mean, what's sad about this story is that Wiesenthal had a very good source that Eichmann was in Argentina in 1953. But he had no facility to go get him. And, you know, he even petitioned individuals within the U.S. government to help. As well as in Israel and elsewhere, and people just didn't believe that his information was correct.
Hey, Neil, can you tell us at this point why it was the United States was so wishy-washy with this Nazi hunting? I know that they kept a lot of Nazi officials in place to run the state, and there was some value of some of these people in terms of American defense. But was that it, or was there just... was there something more that the U.S. government just didn't want to touch these people for some reason?
I mean, I think it's on a number of levels, several of which you mentioned. There were individuals within our security services who were former Nazis. There was the relationship with the West German government who was rife with former Nazis. And I think it was just the fact, much like Israel, we had other security concerns and thought that, you know, chasing the past was not something that was worthwhile.
How did Mossad finally get interested in this? How did Wiesenthal and these other young hunters of war criminals, how did they finally draw Mossad's interest into this?
Well, what's interesting is it wasn't a big international manhunt that eventually found him. It was a young woman, her name was Sylvia Herman, who was 18 years old, living in Buenos Aires, and found herself dating none other than the son of Adolf Eichmann. And she had a suspicion that his father was Adolf Eichmann himself. And through help with a West German prosecutor, they alerted the Mossad. And this was roughly 1957-58.
Okay, so now we're getting close. And where was Eichmann living at this time? Was he not on some kind of a farm or a large estate, and he was working in town at the Mercedes factory, correct?
He was working at the Mercedes factory by 1959, but it was not an estate in by any measure. He was living in a small, what I call a brick bunker of a house in the northern outskirts of Buenos Aires. It had no running water, no electricity. Unlike many Nazis who flourished in Buenos Aires, Eichmann found himself slowly going down, or actually rather rapidly going down the economic ladder.
I didn't mean to say estate, but I thought that there were some grounds there that were rather spread out that perhaps he tended. Maybe I'm mistaken.
Yes,
there.
Correct.
But I do... yeah, it was sort of like out in a more rural section. We're speaking here with Neil Bascom, the author of Hunting Eichmann. Adolf Eichmann, a member of the SS. He was, as Neil pointed out, the man who organized the transport. He's the guy that ordered up the boxcars that human beings were loaded into like animals and were sent off to these death camps. The book Hunting Eichmann, How a Band of Survivors and a Young Spy Agency Chased Down the World's Most Notorious Nazi. And, of course, we're talking about the Israeli Mossad there. So we've got Eichmann at this place. And just curiously here, Neil, you say that he was just not getting it done. He wasn't making it economically. How was it these other former Nazis were, quote-unquote, flourishing? Were they just not high on the list of wanted fugitives? Were they wanted at all?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of them came to Argentina with skills. I mean, you know, Eichmann's skill was transporting and killing Jews. You have Dr. Mengele, for instance, who was a doctor and came from a family with wealth. You know, there's this great misconception that Eichmann had gathered a whole lot of wealth and brought it to Buenos Aires, but that is far from the case. And I think the other fact of it is that Eichmann was a pariah within the Nazi community because he was so red hot that people didn't want to have anything to do with him.
You know, the rest of the world was probably very unconscious to these activities, but in the Nazi underworld, it was well known that Eichmann was being hunted. How is it that their intelligence was even that good, the Nazis that were avoiding Mossad and the Wiesenthals of the world?
Well, I mean, there would be a lot of, you know, conjecture on my part in regard to that. But I think that, you know, you could find that certainly within the West German government, you know, the ambassador to Argentina, for instance, was a, you know, former high-level foreign official within the Nazi Party. So, you know, that you could draw some insights from that.
And before we break, and we're going to continue after the break, tell me the principal Mossad officer who whose attention was grabbed by Wiesenthal and others, the principal individual who motivated Mossad into becoming involved in this.
This was Isser Harel, who was the head of the Mossad as well as the Shin Bet. He was considered the father of the Israeli secret services. And
all right, we're going to come.
Go ahead.
Neil, I'll tell you what we'll do is we'll break, man, and you give me a little more background there, and we'll get into the actual operation that extracted Adolf Eichmann from Argentina and returned him to Israel to face charges for war crimes. We're talking with Neil Bascom, author of Hunting Eichmann. This is the world-famous Phil Henry Show here on Crime Night. We'll be right back.
World-famous Phil Henry Show. The world-famous Phil Henry Show.
Phil Henry Show here with Neil Bascom on Crime Night. Neil is the author of Hunting Eichmann, How a Band of Survivors and a Young Spy Agency Chased Down the World's Most Notorious Nazi. And he did an enormous amount of work. He talked to former Nazi soldiers. He talked with former Mossad operatives. He interviewed the El Al flight crew. This was the plane, the airline that transported Eichmann out of Argentina unwittingly. Correct, Neil? They didn't know that this guy that they had there on the plane, who looked like he was maybe having a problem sleeping, was a war criminal. Is that correct?
Right. I mean, they brought him. I mean, the pilot knew and a couple other people knew, but most of the crew did not know until they actually had wheels up from Buenos Aires, and it was announced that they were carrying none of the Adolf Eichmann, which actually.
So let's get to this operation. So the green light is finally given for this. How does Mossad, they know where Eichmann is now, given this intelligence they've gathered. They know where he works. They know what his daily patterns and his habits are. Where do they begin? How do they get into Argentina? Because Argentina refused steadfastly to extradite this man, didn't they?
Yes. I mean, there was no way that the Israelis were going to tip off the West Germans or the Argentinians about this operation. So they made no extradition moves, and they decided to move in on Eichmann. They recruited about 10 different operatives. They brought them all in under different passports and at different times. It was, you know, a huge orchestration to bring everyone in. And they finally came together, and, you know, they were staying at about 5 or 6 different safe houses, and they had no way to meet each other, these operatives, other than to go to cafes where the Isser Harel was moving from cafe to cafe. But they planned this operation, which was to, first they had to watch Eichmann over the course of several weeks to track his every movement, because they wanted to know where the best place to grab him was. And then they needed to get everything ready, safe houses and cars to grab him in, and finally to get him out of the country.
And so when did they pull the trigger on this? They're watching this man for days and days and days. They're looking at his habits. When did they finally pull the trigger, and what was the plan, and how did it execute?
Well, it was May 11th they chose was the go date. And they chose the location was going to be on his walk home. He walked home every night. He got home around 7:40 in the evening in the dark. And he would walk from his bus stop to his house. And this is a desolate area, several hundred yards. And their plan was to put two cars on the road, one on his particular street and one on the street that he walked towards. And they had the hood up and an operative, you know, sort of fiddling with the engine. And as Eichmann made his way towards his house, they jumped him.
They jumped him, and was he? Did he? I can't imagine he gave them much resistance, but I know that they had some pretty tough dudes there, just in case, right? And
yes,
immediately,
I mean,
did they not?
They had an individual who is, as one of the Mossad agents I interviewed described, you know, had hands the size of baseball mitts. He was a huge monster of a guy, and he was one of the two guys who ended up grabbing Eichmann. But Eichmann actually, you know, put up a bit of a resistance. He did not go as quietly as they thought. And in fact, Eichmann reached into his coat right before they were about to grab him, and the Mossad agent who was going to grab him by the throat and spin him around thought that he was going for a gun, and that brought a bit of a melee, and they fell into a jam. But they finally got him into the car, and from that point forward to the time that he got to Israel, Eichmann was absolutely compliant.
And was he compliant? Of course, we're skipping over a lot of things. I mean, the reason why there's so much secrecy here, folks, you need to understand, Argentina did not want to extradite this man. This was a highly dangerous, and also, Anil, diplomatically, I mean, it was a real, they knew what they were doing here. They were basically kidnapping an Argentinian, taking him out of the country. So they drugged him, didn't they?
They drugged him to get him on the plane, absolutely, because they thought that he was going to put up resistance. And so, you know, on this mission, they had
what kind of drugs did they use, if you don't mind me asking?
They just I don't know the specific, because the doctor is still, to this day, you cannot get to this doctor. I believe he's still alive, but no one's ever mentioned him. The Mossad are quite quiet, so I don't know exactly what drug, but something to make him feel woozy but to keep him awake. So he was conscious and able to speak, but that's about the extent of his abilities at that time.
So they smuggle him onto this El Al flight under what pretense? That he is, was he, did they not say he was a member of the crew or some other kind of fake status?
Yes, they dressed him up as the member of the crew, and they, you know, the idea was that he would be woozy and slightly drunk, and they would bring him through the gates and onto the plane. And, you know, the story of the El Al crew and what they did is probably one of my favorite parts of the story.
Can you give me a little bit of that?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, one of my, again, my favorite scene probably in the whole book is when they finally, you know, after months of this operation, everything carefully done, they have Eichmann on the plane, and they're taxiing away from the airport, and they're told, stop. Air traffic control, stop. You can't go any further. You can't take off. I interviewed the navigator on the plane, and he was the one who volunteered. You know, the pilot and Isser Farrell are in the cockpit saying, what should we do? Should we take off? Should we risk the Argentinian Air Force? And Shaul, the navigator, stands up and says, I'll go check it out. And he steps off the plane, and Isser Farrell says, if you're not back in 5 minutes, we're taking off without you. And this is just an ordinary individual. And this story is rife with these stories of these ordinary people doing these rather extraordinary things.
Very heroic things, yeah. And he is returned to Israel, and certainly the entire trial was televised, and Adolf Eichmann did go to his death. I guess we can say that it was all in all very, very successful, but Israel did pay a little bit of a diplomatic price in those days that followed, didn't they? Wasn't there? There was a great deal of outrage on the part of some that they would go in under the guise of a diplomatic mission. I think they were hiding with the Israeli ambassador and pull this guy out. What kind of reaction internationally was there, Neil?
Well, it was a disaster. And David Ben-Gurion, the head of the Israeli state, sort of went in knowing that it would be a disaster. But he thought that, you know, they had the moral right and obligation to what is, in essence, extraordinary rendition and bringing him to Israel. And so they weathered the United Nations and all the rest.
Oh, by the way, we didn't ask you, why did they stop that plane?
Well, it ended up they had filed a flight plan that was a mistake. It was just a simple mistake. Shaul cleared it up, and they got back on the flight. But that, it certainly doesn't
sweating bullets.
They almost ran out of fuel flying back. So it was
almost,
quite a dangerous mission.
Unbelievable. I mean, what a story, dude. What a story. Congratulations. We're looking forward to reading it. We've had Neil Bascom with us. The book is Hunting Eichmann, How a Band of Survivors and a Young Spy Agency, the Mossad, Chased Down the World's Most Notorious Nazi. And it's terrific stuff. It's great history. And we thank you for being with us tonight on Crime Night.
Really appreciate it. Thanks.
Okay, Neil. It's Crime Night on the world-famous Phil Hendry Show. Phil Hendry Show tonight on Crime Night. We are very happy to have with us Jeff Gwynn. And Jeff is the author of Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde, which received a starred review by the Publishers Weekly. Jeff is also the books editor at the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and he's joining us tonight. And Jeff, you're a writer living in Texas, and this is where the story of Bonnie and Clyde starts. First of all, thanks for being with us. And I want to ask you, What got you interested in this, man, other than the fact you were living, in Texas and Bonnie and Clyde, at least in the case of Bonnie, was she not from Fort Worth or an area known as West Texas or West Dallas, I mean?
Well, actually, both of them were from Dallas slums called West Texas, and that's about 35 miles east of Fort Worth. And what's fascinating about them is over the years I had heard little bits of Bonnie and Clyde lore. But like everybody else, I based my opinion of them on that great movie from 1967 with Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway. But the more I looked into it and the more I learned, I found out that the truth was far different and, to me at least, much more interesting. And I was able to spend about 2 years working on this. And as a result, hopefully we have a better idea of who Bonnie and Clyde really were and what they did accomplish and also what they didn't do.
I agree with you that it's far more interesting than the movie. And I would like you right now, in fact, as long as we're on the subject, what would you say is the major difference between the celluloid Bonnie and Clyde and the Bonnie and Clyde that you came to know through your research?
Well, the movie's all about glamour. And Bonnie and Clyde in real life were the antithesis of glamour. They lived mostly like animals out in a car. They both were crippled. All these things that people don't realize about them. They were much younger, 24 and 23 when they died, than people think because of the movie. They were basically a couple of poor kids who went wrong.
Almost like a Charles Starkweather story, except there was a money motive as opposed to just an overall psychopathic binge, wouldn't you say? They were either one of them in your research. Would you say either one, other than coming from terribly traumatized childhoods, either one mentally ill, like psychotic or psychopathic?
They weren't, but you have to remember the times that they lived in. In the 1920s and early 1930s in particular, America was a place where you stayed in the same economic class you were born into. And so you have two young people living in the slums, very ambitious. Movies are just out so even poor kids can see folks in fancy cars and coats and ties. Mm-hmm. The kind of life they wanted.
And go ahead, sir.
And what would happen, not just with them, but with quite a few other young people, is they'd start stealing small things and it would escalate. In Clyde's case, he moved from chickens to cars to mom-and-pop groceries. They usually didn't rob banks because they were terrible bank robbers.
they got into a hell of a lot of... One thing that your book points out is they got into plenty of gunfights. And they got out of a lot of them, as the movie itself does indicate. Let's start, if we could, with, you know, Bonnie Parker to me was terribly tragic. Here is a girl that was a prostitute at an early age. She, in her diaries, she wrote a poem called The Prostitute's Convention. This is back in the 1920s. She pointed out all the spots in this area that she lived where the prostitutes gathered. She named them all. And like you said, terribly ambitious. So where do these two, and let's talk first also about Clyde Barrow. He was imprisoned. Was this his first murder, the murder of the rapist in prison? Was this the first man he killed?
Right. Clyde was sentenced to 14 years in jail for car theft. but it was really it was 7 2-year terms served concurrently. If he could survive 2 years in prison, he'd be let out. But he was sent to a prison farm outside Huntsville, just the worst prison hellhole in Texas, where the inmates were treated like slaves and used to pick cotton in the fields that the state would sell for a profit. The overseers were actually incarcerated criminals themselves, the meanest, the toughest, and one of them picked on Clyde and began repeatedly raping him. And this happened for almost a year before Clyde finally killed him by hitting him over the head with an iron bar. Another prisoner was blamed for the murder, and Clyde essentially got away with it. But that was the first man he killed, and he was killing him basically in self-defense.
Yes, he was. All right, so let's talk about these two young people who are sort of half trying to make a living and also sort of excited with whatever notoriety they can get. What was their first crime? And I know that I'm passing over their meeting, but people will need to pick this book up because it's just chock full of details. What was the first crime that Bonnie and Clyde committed together?
Well, there were the ones they tried to commit before they actually pulled one off. Mm-hmm. Their first big attempt at robbery involved themselves and one other cohort named Ralph Fultz. And their plan was to rob a couple stores in a small Texas town called Kaufman. Unfortunately, there was a night watchman who saw them. They had to flee. They were in a couple cars that got stuck in the mud. And they tried to get away by riding bareback on mules, one of whom actually bucked Ralph Fultz off. They were surrounded by a posse chasing them. Clyde managed to get away. Bonnie was captured and was held for 3 months before a jury decided she was just some silly, love-struck girl who didn't know any better. When she got out, she rejoined Clyde, and they did begin a series of holdups, or Clyde would do that. Bonnie never actually shot anybody. And the places they would pick on were not big banks. They would have stuck out like sore thumbs. I mean, they were sort of country bumpkins. So they would knock off mom-and-pop grocery stores, and sometimes they'd get so desperate they'd break into gum machines and use the change for meal money. I mean, we're talking the antithesis of criminal masterminds here.
Yeah, there's a fascinating story in your book. Eventually, Buck Barrow joins them, the brother, along with his wife, Blanche. Everybody knows those characters from the movie.
Oh, poor Blanche.
And what's the other thing, too, Jeff, is that you point out in this book, many of the principals lived a long time. Blanche just passed on when?
Blanche passed on about 10 years ago, and she left
10 years ago
diary. But the thing about Buck and Blanche joining them, Buck was just a happy-go-lucky guy who would certainly never have thought about actually shooting somebody. He was in jail, as his brother had been, for car theft. And the Barrow gang, because they were so dumb about calling attention to themselves, I mean, they'd only steal the flashiest cars. Then they'd drive into these poor communities and wonder why everybody was staring at them. They would get surrounded. They would get in shootouts. That's what happened in Joplin when they first got internationally famous. And poor Blanche didn't want to be there at all. She was a preacher's daughter who kept trying to talk Buck into leaving. Gorgeous, gorgeous woman, much prettier than Bonnie, and Bonnie didn't like that a bit. And, of course, in the movie, they were sort of shown as buffoons. They weren't that at all. They were tragically misguided.
Yeah, Blanche made the comment, I think, in your book. She said, I saw the movie, and they just had me like I was some screaming idiot. You know, I screamed all through these events, which she claims she did not. And the other thing about Blanche Barrow is, you point out in your book, though she might have been a good girl and didn't want to be involved in this life, she was very courageous. Now, the shootout where Buck Barrow is very seriously wounded, there's a hole in his skull.
Right.
They're trapped. The cars are facing out, as was Clyde's M.O., and yet when they open the garage door, there is this armored vehicle that the police were using. Yeah, tell me about that. That was in which city? Platte City?
Platte City, just outside Kansas City. And they were there because Clyde was acting like an idiot. They knew that the police were hot on their trail, but Clyde wanted to stay in a nice two-room motel that they'd found there and insisted on staying. He parked the car in the garage there backward, which is what criminals usually did so they could make fast getaways. He sent poor Blanche around buying meals for five people because there were the two couples plus W.D. Jones, their 17-year-old cohort, who, by the way, was afraid of the dark and wouldn't sleep in a room by himself. That's how big, brave a criminal he was.
Right.
They got surrounded by the police. They had to shoot their way out. And Buck was hit by a shot from a Tommy gun that blew out part of his skull. His brain was exposed. But Blanche and Clyde managed to get him into the car, and they drove their way free. That didn't last long. They went into Iowa, got surrounded again, and this time Buck and Blanche were captured, and Buck died soon afterward.
That is a thrilling, amazing, tragic section of your book, that entire shootout there in Platte City. And also, we should point out here, Jeff, and we're talking to Jeff Quinn, by the way, who wrote Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde. If you really want to know the story, you got to read this book. This is where, I had to laugh, this is where Clyde was giving Blanche all of this change to go buy meals, wasn't he? He was saying, go out and get us meals, giving her $5 worth of quarters or nickels or whatever it was, correct?
Right. They just tried robbing three small-town gas stations that didn't have much folding money in the till, so they broke into the gum machines and had pockets full of change. And so here's poor Blanche, knowing that the cops are looking for them everywhere, trying to go to a roadside diner and buy five chicken dinners, because Clyde insisted on chicken, and beer with a handful of nickels. Like, nobody's going to notice this. It was really a comedy of errors as well as terror.
But this is really what tipped off the police, isn't it? And they got the state patrol involved, and by the time the chicken dinners were eaten, they were surrounded by this posse. And yet, they get away. And I don't know how, but you mentioned that Buck and Blanche are eventually surrounded in this large park. But Clyde and Bonnie, who by this point, people should know, when you said crippled, she'd gotten battery acid all over her leg in a prior accident, automobile accident. So she was very, very sick and wounded. He waded across a river, correct? Can you tell us about this miraculous escape in a car that they weren't even sure had gas in it?
Well, we found this wonderful 89-year-old man named Marvell Feller, still living in Dexter, Iowa, who was involved in all this, so we have an eyewitness. Buck and Blanche were captured by the posse, who were still chasing Clyde, Bonnie, and W.D. Jones. W.D. and Bonnie hid in a thicket by the South Raccoon River. Clyde swam across where he ran into a 13-year-old boy, the Marvell Feller, with his dog. And at gunpoint, he was pointing a pistol at the kid. The pistol was out of bullets, but, of course, Marvell didn't know that. He had the kid carry Bonnie to the family Model T that was there in the farm. What they didn't realize was there was no gas in it because the Fellers were too poor to have any. Marvell's father offered to pour kerosene in the car and see if it would run. Now, remember, a posse's coming after them this whole time. Meanwhile, Marvell, who's got all those teenage hormones pumping, is carrying Bonnie, who's fainted from pain, but she's just wearing this thin little nightgown, and as far as he's concerned, he's having the time of his life. His father offered to help carry her, and he said, no, Daddy, I got her. Eventually, they get the car started, and Bonnie and Clyde and W.D. disappear in it. Because their clothes are so tattered and bloody, they have to strip down, and they escape wearing sheets around their bodies. They cut holes in the sheets and stuck their heads through it. So here you have these supposedly fearsome criminals fleeing dressed up like little kids on Halloween.
We're going to take a break. This is an amazing tale of... you know, today, with the modern air mobile that police use and everything else, it's hard to imagine these guys would ever have made it to even the back page of a newspaper. But back in the 30s, Bonnie and Clyde had these gun battles and these miraculous escapes. And we're going to continue here with Jeff Quinn, the author of the book, Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde. It's not a glamorous story, I should say. There's a few miracles along the way. We'll be back with Jeff here on Crime Night on the world-famous Phil Hendry Show.
Phil Hendry.
Phil Henry back here with Jeff Gwynn on Crime Night, the author of Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde. It's gotten a starred review by Publishers Weekly. I've read it. It's a wonderful book, and it has so much detail. And as I was talking to Jeff earlier, many of the principals lived well into the latter part of the 20th century, Blanche Barrow being one of them. And there's a photograph, too, an amazing photograph you have, Jeff, in the book of the actual capture of Blanche Barrow and Clyde Barrow as she is straining against the, you know, the arms of these law enforcement, thinking that a camera that's being pointed at her is a gun. She's wearing sunglasses because she did get glass in her eye from a shattered windshield, and she's straining against these individuals. That's an amazing photograph, man. I had never seen that before. That's archival, I guess. Did you have to dig deep for a lot of these pictures?
Well, in one way, we got lucky because there are some surviving members of the Barrow and Parker families who cooperated with the book. And they mm-hmm. actually came up with two unpublished memoirs, one by Clyde's mother and one by Clyde's sister. So we had a lot of access to information that people hadn't had before. That helped mm-hmm. to tell the story, certainly. And even though we don't want to forgive in any way what Clyde and Bonnie did, I mean, lots of young people in Depression were desperate, and they didn't go around killing people and robbing banks. But mm-hmm. I think we get a better idea of what motivated for them. Desperate poverty, a lot of ambition, and boy, did they love being in the newspapers.
They and this leads us to really the eventual the end of Bonnie and Clyde, which is, you know, a shoe. It's a car riddled with bullets. I wanted to back up just a little bit and let people know that D.W. Jones was sort of quasi covered by C.W. Moss in the movie. This is the young teenage kid that Bonnie and Clyde were traveling with. Now, who was on their tail? Frank Nash, I know, was one of them, and he's a man who I think sued the producers of the film and won some kind of a settlement because they made the primary Texas Ranger chasing these people look like some sort of a buffoon who got his picture taken with them and it was plastered in all the papers. That didn't happen, correct?
No, it didn't. The posse that tracked them down was headed by a retired Texas Ranger named Frank Hamer. And he was
Frank Hamer, I'm sorry.
He was maybe the only lawman in America who was as famous as Bonnie and Clyde were. He's 6'3", over 200 pounds, is credited with killing 53 people already in pursuing them. And he was hired by the state of Texas to track them down after Clyde was part of a prison break at Easton Prison Farm and broke out some other criminals, including Henry Methven, whose family eventually betrayed him. And this was the first time there was any organized, smart pursuit of the Barrow Gang. Previously, it was just local lawmen trying to go after them. And Clyde always had faster cars, and he stole higher caliber guns and so forth so he could outrun them. And if he couldn't do that, he could outshoot them. But Hamer very methodically tracked him towards Louisiana, where Methven's family lived. He cut a deal with the Methvens that Henry would be pardoned for his crimes in Texas if they had betrayed Bonnie mm-hmm. and Clyde. Mm-hmm. And with another retired Texas Ranger, two Dallas deputies, and two local Louisiana cops, he set up an absolutely brilliant ambush just outside Gibbsland, Louisiana. He knew exactly what time Bonnie and Clyde would be driving by, and things went perfectly according to his plan. As one of the deputies said after the shootout when he was talking to his family about it, when all was said and done, they weren't nothing but a bunch of wet rags.
Hmm. And what exactly was the arsenal here they opened up on them with?
Well, we're fortunate because the so-called death car is still made public in viewing at a casino in Prim, Nevada. And a ballistics expert from Colorado was allowed to examine it. There were several powerful machine guns, a couple Colt Monitor rifles whose bullets could punch right through car doors. The coroner, examining the bodies later, said that Bonnie had 53 potentially fatal wounds and Clyde had 51. They absolutely slaughtered them, and Clyde and Bonnie did not get off a single shot in their own defense.
The other thing, too, Jeff, is that the photographs you show as the car's being towed into town and it's gathering this parade of people who are onlookers, there's the body of Clyde Barrow, his head leaning against the car door, his mouth open in death. This was seen by all of the people as this car was towed into the town. And And of course, I have to think nowadays, you know, with all of these police investigations, 53 shots alone for Bonnie Parker. I wonder how many cops would be in front of a judge for that now. But what a great book, Jeff. I appreciate so much you taking time to talk with us about it, man. I hope people go look it up and read it. It's great history, man.
Well, thanks a lot, and thank you very much for letting me be on your show.
You got it. Jeff Gwynn, author of Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde, which received, as I mentioned, a great review from Publishers Weekly. Please check it out. And Jeff is over there at the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. He's the book editor over there. We'll be back here. Check us out on Twitter, twitter.com/RealPhilHenry. It's the world-famous Phil Henry Show.
Phil Henry.